and our topic today is Out of Egypt. As I shared the first day, much of this presentation comes out of this book that I wrote that came out in 2010, and another one that I'm working on. So these presentations are helping me write the second book, too. And there are a few copies maybe in the bookstore still, and I have a few here if anyone is interested. And these presentations also come out of my exploration of the intersection between science and Christian theology. Remember the Zacchaeus story here? I think that's how you spell it. That's a tough one. Zacchaeus, Jesus came to town, and Zacchaeus could not see him because he was small in stature. So he climbed up on a tree, and now from that vantage point, he could see Jesus. And it's almost like everyone needs a tree. And for some, their tree is maybe music, art, or carpentry. And at different times in my life, I've had, I think, different trees. Right now, science, what I'm learning as a lay person in science, is sort of it's opening my eyes to other things. It's my tree. And I'm sure every one of you have your tree. A couple of books I'd also recommend here. Biblical Amnesia, Scott Gustafson. He's an ELCA pastor in Baltimore, I think, area. Biblical Amnesia. We think we know the biblical story. And he's gone in there and said, well, here's what we think we know, but let's take another look at it. And you go, yeah, I had forgotten about that. And so it was really helpful in a lot of ways. And then, of course, Daniel Erlander, who's a friend to Holden Village. Anybody know him or met him? Yeah, just a remarkable guy. And this book, it looks like it's an easy book because there's a lot of pictures, but it's just so profound. I commend both of those books to us. On Monday, we looked at God's evolving story of life. We talked about Eden being good, not perfect, or the Hebrew word tov. We talked about the vastness of God's creation and the oldness of God's creation. And I don't know, have you ever thought about why did God make everything so big? Why is that? And you and I are very small, and we're only going to see a very small part of it. And so it can't just be made for us. And we looked at this timeline here, starting at the bottom, universe 13.7 billion years old, and Earth around for 4.6, and single cell life 3.8. It took a long time for multiple cell life to emerge. And kind of going up the road here, and just sort of this amazing story of life. And we started to think about how recent Homo sapiens are, that's us, and how recent Judaism and Christianity is. And again, talked about how Eden was good, not perfect. And how perfection, that's a Greco-Roman later construct that was imposed on the Hebrew worldview. God didn't make the world perfect. God made the world good. And good includes all the things we talked about, fall and winter and spring, and earthquakes, and love, and brokenness, and death, and life. God made the world good. And I suggested yesterday that part of our problem is we don't think good is good enough. We're addicted to something other than what God has made. And that sort of pursuit of the other than what is here is maybe part of the reason we're wrecking things so much. There are actually people who prefer to go to a mall rather than hike to Holden Lake. Or prefer to watch a canoe trip on TV rather than go on a canoe trip. We talked about how our humanity too, we're in the Genesis 2 story, we're the Adam, the human creature is made from the Adama, the soil, we're earthlings. And we're connected to our family of origin, the earth. And the creation story in Genesis 1, I suggested that when God, the storyteller had God say, let us make humankind in our image, God was talking to all the other creatures of the earth. And that we are made in the image of both God and in the image of all other life forms. And if we forget either of those, we're in trouble. I don't know if I can biblically defend that. I think I disagree with the biblical testimony on that score. Can you do that? I don't know. I do sometimes. We had some questions. Okay, if this universe is so vast and so old, why is Judaism and Christianity so recent? Why is the message of the Old Testament, New Testament, the reign of God, that this is the Father's will, and why is it addressed to Homo sapiens? And then we looked in our study yesterday at this thing called the fall. You know, the Apostles' Creed. I believe in God the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. What comes next? We just left out 13.7 billion years of physics, biology, geology, chemistry, of life. And we even left out this fall story. I wonder why. And I said, I had this theory that one of the reasons that Christianity and Judaism came so recently is that recently, in the Homo sapien segment of the story of life, recently our species began to go nuts, began to adopt a new narrative. We exchanged the narrative of the whole community of life, all creatures, including Homo sapiens, that the earth belongs to the whole community of life, including us. And we exchanged that for a narrative that said, the earth belongs to us. Call that human exceptionalism. We are special. We are separate from the world. We are superior to the world. We are the reason for the world. We are the rulers of the world. Or as Protagoras said, man is the measure of all things. I suggested that that is what the fall story is addressing. It's addressing a change in the worldview in our species that the biblical storytellers were finding troubling. They were starting to maybe bump up against neighboring cultures that were acting as though they thought the world belonged to them. What's wrong with those people? Well, maybe they ate of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So they came up with this parable. And the tree of knowledge of good and evil, nobody knows what it stands for. My thought is maybe it stands for the domain of God. And God said, stay away. You can't handle it. It's too powerful for you. And our problem is we have trespassed into the domain of God, eaten of the fruit, and now we think we're wise. And we may be able to eat of the fruit, but we're not able to digest it. Only God can do that. So we're so dangerous because we think we're wise. We left the Creator's house and God's reign and instead declared our house and our reign. And because of that, we have become out of relationship with the creation. We just are disconnected, out of relationship with our neighbor, with our own inner spirit and soul and self, and with the ground of it all, God the Creator. And the saddest verse in the Bible came, Genesis 6:6, the Lord was sorry he had made the humankind on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out from the earth humankind that I have created. Apparently God considered that for a while, destroying us for the sake of the world. But then as Daniel Erlander, in his book Man and Mercy, helped me to see, God must have reflected a little bit more and thought, well, can a mother kill her kids, some of her kids? And so God decided, well, instead of to destroy them, maybe I will try to fix them. A little bit more on this, the trespassing. The Garden of Eden story and the fall story is in a sense us declaring war on God's reign. And it's declaring war on God's garden. Substituting horticulture and responsible agriculture, which has been around for thousands of years. We began to practice totalitarian agriculture, meaning we just consume and consume and consume. We became insatiable consumers. We overrun life forms and, hey, what's the big deal about that? It's for us anyway. Become hoarders. Remember the Exodus story? The manna had been put on the ground and you were to gather enough for the day, and some people gathered more. And what happened to that manna? It's rotted. As Daniel Erlander said, hoarding stinks. We've declared war on God's garden. Now, this issue of dominion, you know, that's part of the biblical witness. In Genesis 1 and other places, God gave humanity dominion. Well, here's what I think about that. And that's just my opinion. You can't have it. It's already taken. You got to find your own opinion. My opinion is that if the biblical storytellers meant by dominion, exploitation, and abuse, they were wrong. And we need to throw that out. But there are other ways to look at it. My wife and I have two daughters, and when they were little, in a sense as parents, we had dominion in relationship to them. Now, if that meant exploitation and abuse, you should put us in jail. If it meant nurturing them and supporting them and allowing them to grow and develop and become who they are so that they become a blessing to our world, then it's a okay thing. The same way with marriage. I've been married for 37 years. In a sense, Nancy has dominion in relationship to me, and I have dominion in relationship to her. If that means exploitation and abuse, put us in jail. If it means nurturing one another so that the other may flourish and grow and become who God made them to be, and so that the marriage may flourish and the family may flourish, and that as a team we may become a blessing to the world or to our community, then it's a good thing. But I gotta tell you, I think that word is problematic. I don't know if it can be redeemed or not. That's just my opinion. Even the word stewardship, we talk about Christian stewardship. The world doesn't need us to steward it. It does just fine on its own. What it does need is for us to start stewarding ourselves and start self-regulating and being a responsible participant in the world. So we care for the earth, but we have to make sure we understand, no, the earth doesn't need to be cared for. It needs us to behave responsibly. We declared war on Abel. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the Cain and Abel thing, but Abel represents those cultures and those peoples and those individuals that live as part of the community of life. And Cain represents those cultures that are at war with the community of life. At a certain point in history, humans started to put food under lock and key, rather than for all. And if it's under lock and key, that means you have to do certain things in order to get it. And some people are worthy of it, and some people are not. And then, around that time, we started to put land under lock and key. And right now, we're putting water under lock and key. There are corporations all over the world that are buying up water so that they can sell it to us. We declared war on Abel. Whenever Abel appears, Cain rises up to kill him. That happens still today. We commandeer Abel's resources, lay waste to his culture, trample his language into the dust. I went to a workshop on mining, and it was at the my university, not my university, the university that I'm at. And the word sustainability was in there. And the people there were people from multinational mining corporations. There were World Bank people there. Some pretty high-polluting people. And they were genuinely trying to mine more responsibly because the history is terrible. We're talking to somebody, was that at breakfast you're talking about? Or maybe you said that, a mine in Haiti where the company had just toxins all over the place. And when the earthquake happened, that was some of the land that the survivors had to go to and set up homes in. But anyway, the people were trying to be more responsible. They had anthropologists working for this company. So that if they went to, say, Senegal, and there was minerals underneath this village, the company would really work with the people in order to make life a little better for them, and then they would get the minerals. But the bottom line was, we're going to get your minerals, and we're going to either be nice about it, and we prefer to be nice about it, but if we can't, then we'll use other means. The other means have to do with bribing politicians, have to do with war and leveraging by military threats and so forth. That kind of, that goes on all the time. And it's to feed us, our appetites, and destroy Abel's ecosystem. Some of you were talking at breakfast about we ship our toxins to other countries. And paying for it. Well, you're starting to do that. We declared war on God's reign, God's garden, on Abel, and on other kings. A lot of the wars today are kings fighting other kings. And we're a king culture, and I'm a king. I'm part of a king culture. We talked about dominion. And the whole creation, including Homo sapiens, we're part of creation, is groaning. So the creator's dilemma is, well, what are we going to do with this creature? destroy them? And try to heal. And apparently, God decided to try to heal us. And so the good news is, besides God's primary mission, which is the evolving story of life, which has been going on for 13.7 billion years, it is vast and is wondrous. God decided to take on a secondary mission. I'm going to try to fix this creature. This creature that has left the father's house, the mother's house, I'm going to try to heal them and bring them back and help them take up some of the dwelling places that are for them. The question is, how is God going to do that?
But, okay, all right, got it.
How is God going to do that? And that's what we're going to talk about today. Yes?
In your language, you have got a secondary mission, try and heal. Try to heal us, as we seem to be particularly resistant at times.
Yeah. Yeah, God's got his work cut out for him, huh? So today we're looking at how. Okay. And I think we've kind of explored this. Abel is a leaver, meaning you take what is needed and you leave the rest. Cain is a taker. It takes and takes and takes and takes. I go fishing each year in Idaho with a buddy of mine, and we hike into a different mountain lake each day and catch trout, like Bob did yesterday at Heart Lake. Trout like this. No, trout like this. And sometimes if we get there early in the summer, we're maybe the first people who have come to this lake after the snow has melted. And there have been several times where on every cast we catch a fish. And the temptation is to just catch all you can. Just take and take and take and take and take. And if there wasn't a limit, a six fish limit, I mean, it's just, let's get all we can. And the notion of saying, well, take what you need and leave the rest. What do you mean leave the rest? If I don't take it, someone else will. Or maybe they won't bite another day. There's just this impulse to take and take and take.
Ron?
Yes?
Is it fair to say that we are all Cain's and Abel's? In other words, there's a distinction here that I find a little awkward.
Yeah.
I mean, who is an Abel that's in the room? I mean, you're making such a black and white distinction.
Yeah. Well, can we be both Cain and Abel? And I think we can go back and forth. But I think we can't, I don't think we can be both at the same time.
Is one distinction I'm wondering is, if we think of ourselves as an aggregate, as a whole, it might be more easy to identify the Cain. Because what I hear you pushing at is the simultaneous justificatio.
Right,
it's the
simultaneously
justified and guilty. And I guess from my perspective, it's really easy to see it if we look at the aggregate. We do act. I mean, look at the board of, we used 43 gallons per person of water yesterday.
Yeah.
That's a lot. Yeah. And we're supposedly here because we do things better than other people. So.
That's an important question. The simul justus et peccator is certainly our theology, and I buy it, and at the same time, saint and sinner. In terms of worldview, I would just kind of lay out, is it possible to have the worldview that the world was made for the whole community of life, including our species, and have the worldview that it's for us? I think that's where it there, and I hate black and white kind of things. And maybe there is gray in between, but there is, I've just been kind of exploring that worldview. Okay, so how are you gonna fix this? So, in the biblical story, God seems to have tried a few things. Tried Noah and the flood. I'm calling this a parable. And that's just my view. That it's not historical. There certainly have been floods in many cultures. But I'm suggesting that this is a parable and that it's not historical. And my reasoning is, first of all, I don't care to believe in a God of genocide. A God that would kill every living creature on earth. I guess the fish were left okay. in the sea and the lakes and the rivers. But that would kill. I just don't choose to believe in a God like that. And I choose to say it's a parable. And parables have a point. And what's the point of this parable? The point of this parable is, if you think you can get rid of evil by killing a bunch of people, think again. Because Noah and his family pick up the slack of evil almost immediately. Noah, of course, gets stone drunk. And he curses one of his sons. Can you, think about that if you're a dad or a parent, cursing one of your children. And then as that was played out in history, people picked up on that. Well, Ham has been cursed, and maybe that's who the people we enslave are, descendants of Ham. So the evil was in Noah and his family. So I think it's a parable with a point that says, if you think you can get rid of evil by killing, it doesn't work. That's my view. It's probably strange. It's probably not held by anybody. But in a sense, I'm saying God tried the flood, only he tried it as a parable. This is kind of interesting. In the story, it talks about the windows of rain coming from the windows of heaven, and, or water from the windows of heaven and the fountains of the deep. This is sort of the world view of that time. There was this firmament above there, and there's all those stars up there. They must be holes, and water seems to come from there. That must be where the water comes from. And then, of course, when you dig down in the ground, you found water there, so there must be water there. So in this flood, it was not only rain coming from the sky, but it was water, flooding up from the deep. That was the image that they were using. So then God tried, well, maybe if I can find a certain people and teach them how to live, then maybe they can become a model for the rest of their species and help them to figure things out. Someone want to read this passage? Who's got a good reading voice? Or adequate?
Good, not good.
In the days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the highest of mountains and shall be raised above the hills. All nations shall stream to it. Many peoples shall say, come, let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways of being in the world, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth instruction and the word of God from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and shall arbitrate for many peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore.
So, God thought, I'll look for a group of people, and I'll teach them how to live. So, he found some folks in Egypt. who were slaves.
Anyway, I look this year.
And what was Egypt like? Egypt was Cain's world. I get this kind of from Daniel Erlander too, and adapted a little bit. This is Cain's world. At the top is the king, the royalty, the people with wealth, the people with means. And there are the people who have land, because land is wealth. And then there are people that are the workers, the farmers, the tradespeople, teachers. And there's slave labor, either those who are actually slaves or those who work for slave wages. And there are the surrounding poor nations that this system sucks resources from to feed itself. And then there's the community of life that is trampled upon and abused.
John, what's the time period? Do you have any idea what the time period is?
Of this, isn't it like 12, 13, 1400 BC?
Okay.
Something like that.
It's a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
right, yeah. But this is how Cain's world operates. And God said, I'm going to teach people a different way to live. Now, he wasn't saying, okay, Israel, you're here. I'm going to rescue you so that next time you can be here. Or here. No, he was going to teach them a whole different way of being in the world. So, out of Egypt, the Exodus story. Anybody got a Bible in there? Let's do just a little bit of reading. Exodus 1. There were five women who we need to make note of in this Exodus story. Would someone read Exodus 1, 15 to 22? Shipra and Pua.
The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shipra and the other Pua, when you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and seat him on the birth stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, she shall live. But the midwives feared God. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and allowed the boys to live? The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them. So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, the boy that is born to the Hebrews, you shall throw into the Nile, that you shall let every girl live.
So these two women had the courage to disobey Pharaoh. They were not going to do it. And they were sneaking and sly about it. It went on. Can someone read this next verse? This is Moses' mother.
Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank.
Okay. She disobeyed Pharaoh too. She hid Moses for 3 months, and then when she could no longer do that, in a sense she obeyed Pharaoh, she threw him in the river. Sneaky. But she put him in a basket. Yeah. Someone read the next verse here, Miriam.
Should say 2:4 then if you want the next verse.
Okay. Yeah, 2. You're right. 2:2:2. Yes, you're right. The next verse, please.
His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him.
Okay. She disobeyed Pharaoh too. And then Pharaoh's daughter, this is Exodus 2:5-10.
Soon after this, one of Pharaoh's daughters came down to bathe in the river, and her servant girls walked along the river bank. When the princess saw the little basket among the reeds, she took hold of one of her servant She told one of her servant girls to get it for her. As the princess opened it, she found the baby boy. His helpless cries touched her heart. He must be one of the Hebrew children, she said. Then the baby's sister approached the princess. Should I go and find one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you, she said. Yes, do, the princess replied. So the girl rushed home and called the baby's mother. Take this child home and nurse him for me, the princess told her. I will pay you for your help. So the baby's mother took him home and nursed him.
So, it doesn't really say exactly, but Pharaoh's daughter, I mean, she must have known what was going on.
This is why women are so sneaky.
Yes. That's right. And this is an affirmation already starting. God's, you know, trying to teach a people how to be in this world. And part of it is resisting Pharaoh. And you have to be sneaky. And then he got these people and he took them out into the Sinai desert for 40 years of wilderness school. That's a Daniel Erlander term. To teach them how to live. And with that we get the commandments and everything and all kinds of lessons of life and the man in the wilderness and the water and the quail falling from the sky and so forth. Teaching them how to live. It took 40 years. They left Pharaoh's Egypt. It's important to know that God did not set the people free in order for them to be free. Freedom is a false god. And terrible things have been done in the name of freedom by individuals, groups, and nations. God did not set them free in order for them to be free. God set them free in order to teach them an alternative way of living. So we have to watch the word freedom. It gets thrown around in politics a lot and can justify some horrific things. So, after a while, and the story of Israel then, and this comes especially from this book, Biblical Amnesia, is Israel kind of going back and forth between Cain's way and Abel's way. And at times they're Abel's way, and then they think, well, man, back in Egypt at least we had food, and maybe we should go back to that way. And it's sort of back and forth and back and forth. And at some point, they started to say, they look around at the neighbors, and their neighbors have a king, and their neighbors seem to have more stuff. Maybe we should have a king too. Would someone read this passage right here? It's in the Old Testament.
And it came to pass, when Samuel was old, that he made his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second, Abiah. They were judges in Beersheba. And his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre, and took bribes and perverted judgment. Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together, and came to Samuel unto Ramah, and said unto him, Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, Give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed unto the Lord. And the Lord said unto Samuel, Hearken unto the voice of the people, and all that they say unto thee, for they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even unto this day, wherewith they have forsaken me, and served other gods, so do they also unto thee.
So, they wanted a king. And Samuel, who was kind of a chaplain for Israel, said, You don't need a king. The Lord is our king. And they kept pestering him And finally, Samuel went to God and said, the people want a king. They're rejecting me. And God said, they're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me. So we forget, in terms of biblical amnesia, not only was the monarchy not God's idea, but God was against it. We forget that. The next passage here, I don't think I have time to look at it. You could look at it later. But basically it says, okay, you want a king? Here's what that's going to be like. And then he talks about, you know, your sons are going to be conscripted into the army, and you're going to have taxes, and you're going to get into more and more of this king world. So they went the direction of the monarchy. First it was Saul. Saul started out pretty good. He ended up as corrupt as can be. They went to David. David started out pretty good. He ended up as corrupt as can be. The David and Bathsheba story, which is a story of rape and murder. Now, I use the word rape intentionally. When the king sees you taking a bath, and the king sends a soldier to come and get you, and then you have sex, or the indifference of power there, it seems like a rape to me. And then when he was found, or then when she became pregnant, Bathsheba, Bathsheba was married to Uriah, who was one of David's soldiers. So then Uriah worked it out. First of all, he tried to have him come home on leave and have he and Bathsheba sleep together so he could say it was his child. And when he wouldn't do that, he had him killed. He put him in the front lines of the next battle. He arranged the battle. Can you imagine a leader arranging a battle to take care of some personal stuff? But it's important to realize that not only is the David and Bathsheba story a story of personal failing, it's also a metaphor for how this works. This is what this system does in the world. Solomon started out wise, good, ended up as corrupt as possible. He even built a temple to God using enslaved men and women. Can you imagine anything more contradictory to God? And he was a bit of a consumer. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Plus palaces, had all kinds of wealth. And so in this story, what we find happening is that in this cycle from beginning to here, we come full circle. Solomon has become just another pharaoh. Egypt has become just another, or Israel has become just another Egypt. The monarchy produced Cain's way of being in the world. And Israel became Cain. We forget that. We honor King David. We honor Solomon was so wise. And we forget the narrative that this is taking place. Now, we have to be careful. You know that in the Bible, there's many different writers, and there's many strains of theology. And there are some sources in these stories that like the king, and will write stories and passages that lift up the king as a great way. And then there's another strain that is more in this, and I've kind of picked out that strain. The Bible has many theologies, has many strains, and sometimes they're melded together and it's hard to figure them out. And you have to study Hebrew and stuff like that in Greek to kind of say, okay, this looks like this was put together by someone else. but there's a different strain. It's kind of like the Noah and the flood story. There's one strain that has the animals going in two by two. All the creatures went in by pairs, except the worms, they came in apples. That's pastor humor. But then there's another strain in there that says there were, and maybe you remember this, Mary, seven pairs of clean animals and one pair of unclean animals, or maybe it was seven pair of unclean animals. So you can definitely see that there's sort of two different strains, sources going on there. So God tried the flood. Did someone say something? Well, God tried chosen people, and what happened was that the people started to think that their chosenness meant special status rather than special service. And this could happen to Christians too. So God tried the law. Well, maybe if I have a bunch of commandments, they'll learn how to live. But the thing about law is, it's we need laws. But they don't fix us. They don't heal us. There's an old story that pastors used to tell about a mom and dad that had three kids. The mom and dad needed to go into town to get some groceries. So they left the kids at home with this commandment. Whatever you do, don't put a penny up your nose. So they go into town, buy the groceries, come back 2 hours later. Sure enough, one of the kids has a penny up their nose. Another one has a nickel up his nose, saying, "You just said we couldn't do a penny." And the third one obeyed that rule that was a terror in everything else. Law doesn't necessarily heal. So God tried prophets. Well, maybe if I scare the living daylights out of these people, they'll shape up. But even fear is kind of a funny thing, too. It's kind of like when you get a speeding ticket. Anybody ever had one? You drive really carefully for about 3 weeks. And then we're back to our old habits. So, this is another book I recommend, Walter Brueggemann. This is more kind of, I think I've sort of made the point the different ways. Pharaoh's way as opposed to God's way. Cain's way as opposed to Abel's way. It's sort of the Lord's way of being in the world is steadfast love, justice, and righteousness. Pharaoh's way of being in the world is wisdom, might, and wealth. And what I mean by that is Pharaoh's way, Cain's way, Taker's way, Jabba the Hutt. You know Jabba the Hutt from Star Wars or Pizza the Hutt from Spaceballs? So Jabba the Hutt is this huge, grotesque consumer that just pulls things in, devours it. There are cultures in this world, and ours is one of them, I would suggest. We're a Jabba. We don't see what we do. But to feed us, it takes there's a lot of snarfing going on to the world's resources. And we like to think that our military protects the innocent and protects us from bad people. And it does a portion. But a larger portion is that even having a military like ours, even if you don't shoot one single gun or missile, It bends the world in our favor. It disposes the world's resources towards our consumption and our entitlement. And we think that because we have money, if you have a resource in your country and we want that, we have a right to that, and you don't have a right to stop us from having it. Anyway, in this way of thinking, wisdom and smarts is used to control mystery and to reduce the world to technology. Might and power is used to build more might and power in the name of security. Wealth is a leverage to feed acquisitive appetites. This is a phrase from Brueggemann, militaristic consumerism. Our military, and no individual soldier really thinks about this, but it's there to bend the world our way because we have acquisition entitlement mentality. These are just my opinions.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Could you go back to the first comment, wisdom and smarts? Could you dig into that a little more deeply? I'm not sure I understand what you're saying.
Well, the word mystery is kind of interesting, that there's a lot of mystery in life, and God is mysterious, and there's a tendency to want to explain everything away and to control it and to manage it. And at a place like this, we see so much of the creation here. And technology is one sliver, but we as a culture seem to have made the choice to have technology kind of lead us through history and define what life is about and who we are. So it's sort of a reducing of the grandness of God to something small. And we are so fascinated by our technology. But it's one piece of life. We have made it the piece of life, I would suggest. Does that make any sense? Or?
What you said, I follow, but when you talk about controlling mystery, I guess I'm still not clear on that, because it seems that inquiry, scientific inquiry,
right,
and questioning things and trying to understand things that once upon a time was a mystery,
okay,
is not necessarily a bad thing.
Right. So how do we be inquisitive and also respectful of what we don't know or can't know? Sort of that dilemma. So God tried all these things, flood, chosen people, law, prophets, and it seems as though Cain is gaining strength among our species. The gospel is God is trying to heal us. Besides God's primary mission, God's also doing the secondary thing on the side, trying to fix these people. But God's way, Cain's way of being in the world still seems to dominate. We seem to be getting more out of relationship. So here's the question, and this is kind of a teaser for tomorrow, where we're going to look at what is this Jesus thing all about? If you were God, and you had this problem with one of your creatures, what would you do? What would you do? Let's just throw that open here for a little bit.
Try and get face to face.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about the question earlier about the difference between being able within ourselves, and it's almost like, I mean, it's not really about it on an individual
basis. This is so difficult. I mean, even if you want to be enabled, even if you act like an enabled, even if you try to live your life out that way, here, like in the United States, or in any other sort of wealthy landowner situations, you just, I mean, it, that's part of that society, that's part of that culture. You're almost like Jonah wandering around and just sort of trying to holler at everybody, they're not listening. It's, it'd be so, like, even if you want to be enabled, you're a king. I mean, you live in a society where the land is owned, so it's locked up. You're taking, I mean, if you have any sort of wealth, technology, I mean, it's just coming from, it almost can't exist without that situation. And so the enabled societies are just these sort of smaller remnants out there, really, anymore.
The word remnant, remnant theology has really started to resonate in my
yeah,
mind.
I mean, because even third world countries, even poorer situations are all still part of that. Mm-hmm. That pyramid,
yeah.
they're not a separate way of being. So like, they may not be kings because they're sort of down there in the. I mean, it's not an individual kind of thing. So there's even the able societies that are left are still sort of swallowed up. I think. Mm-hmm.
As it relates to that, I'm sorry, I don't know your name. I'm Joe. What is your name?
James.
James. I think James raises a really good point, and it really makes me wonder about, the whole idea that many of you have probably read about the collective goods dilemma, Mansur Olson, The Logic of Collective Action is a book that he wrote years ago, and it's about people working together on a collective good, and then you've got the free rider problem, the people who benefit from the good but don't do anything to make the good come about. So you have to figure out a way to get over the free rider problem. In a way, you know, what we're talking about here, what James is bringing up, is an aggregation of behavior that to some extent is beyond individual, or seemingly beyond individual capacity to, you know, to deal with. But in a way, it kind of goes back to a different collective action dilemma. And I don't think it's ever really been kind of thought through with logic and mathematics the way that Mansur Olson did. And so the question would be, how do people come together to be more like an able? And this is kind of the dilemma that the environmental movement, particularly that's informed by theology, has faced. How do they come together in a collectivity to overcome this individual, the problem of an individual? And it's not a free rider problem so much as how do they overcome this aggregation of human behavior that's beyond individuals. You know, it's kind of like what you saw under the Nazi regime. It was an aggregation that was evil. It was, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I just think it's really an interesting question. And I would raise the question of, what kind of collective goods dilemma is this? It's different than the one that Mansur Olson talked about. I'm sorry, maybe that's a little bit off track here.
Yes, Bob.
The remnant comment brought up something that you said about stewardship that I had a question about originally.
Mm-hmm.
And there was dominion there and then stewardship.
Yeah.
Underneath, and your comment was nature can take care of itself, or should. And I agree, but we live in a broken nature, we live in a remnant nature, there's islands of nature, of pure nature, that possibly, in many cases, are so out of balance that they need almost an emergency band-aid of what I would call stewardship, remedial help. With God would come into this, in my opinion, through humanity's compassion, wisdom, collective action.
What's your name? Paul?
Bill.
Bill. Bill brought up an interesting comment, too, about that. So there's parts of nature that are sick because of human behavior.
Yes.
And are you referring to that?
That was the unbalance that I was talking
okay.
about.
And
instance.
Then stewardship is trying to right the wrong. Bill brought up the idea that just like in humanity, in our species, there's brokenness. Maybe there's brokenness also in the whole in creation too, in places. Maybe there are viruses aren't so good or whatever. And that's something I'm thinking about too. So stewardship, our stewardship, yeah, we need to fix what we break, but we don't need to manage the world. We need to manage ourselves.
My thought was, I didn't interrupt you.
No.
Some of the people the environmentalists that I live and are friends with, are preservationists versus stewards.
Okay.
And preservationist is keep it as is. And that's what I sensed when you were saying let the earth be by itself. And that's what brought on my comment about, hey, we're bleeding, we need some remedial care, we need a band-aid in certain places. It's got to be a wise band-aid. Mm-hmm. Theologically, it needs to be a God band-aid through, mediated through, I would say, Homo sapiens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow we're going to bring Jesus into this equation, and I actually think there's a lot of hope there, but we'll kind of explore that tomorrow. Okay? Thank you.